All right, Shisha, so let's see if any of these apply to you, okay? You've done the therapy, you've read the books, but you have yet to dip your toe into the somatic healing pond. You still find yourself having reactions that are out of proportion to the situation at hand. You live in a constant low-grade state of hypervigilance, like you're waiting for the other shoe to drop. Or you're on the opposite end, you're checked out, disconnected, floating through life like your head is a completely separate entity from the rest of your body. You live in chronic tension, your shoulders are up to your ears like mine, or your jaws clenched, hips tight, lower back pain. Or you deal with digestive issues, or you're constantly tired in a way that sleep just doesn't seem to fix. And last but not least, you're craving a place to heal with other cool people where you can just show up as your whole messy self and be accepted for it. So if any of those applied to you, and let's get real, shit shows, at least one of those applied to you, it's time that you sign the hell up for Breathe to Heal. This 7-week journey kicks off on Tuesday, January 13th. It's led by Teresa, fellow Shit Show member and somatic and breathwork practitioner, and it combines the 3 modalities that literally helped me thaw out of functional freeze and start moving my life in the direction I actually wanted. Breath work, somatic practices, and parts work. This is a steal compared to other somatic programs out there with 2 and 3 month payment options to make it more accessible. So yes, you, let's do the damn thing already. Head to adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal. That is breathe with an E at the end, adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal to get your damn spot and thank me later.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
When you let go of what no longer serves you, you create space for what's meant to be. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child.
What you're holding on to, just let it all go. What's making you slow now, just let it all go.
Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows, and a Merry Christmas Eve to you and yours. For any listeners, my name is Andrea. I am your resident recovering shit show. I am a recovering alcoholic. I'm an adult child of an alcoholic and dysfunctional family. I am a recovering anxious attacher. I am a lover of carbs, condiments, and cheese, and I am just trying to get through the last week or so of the year without any more emotional breakdowns, just like the rest of y'all. So welcome aboard this hot mess of a healing ship. We curse here. You have been warned. So today, folks, we are diving deep with returning guest, fan fave, household name in the complex trauma world, the one and only Nate Postlewaite. Now, if you're not familiar with Nate's backstory, like his childhood, his complex trauma bottom, how he navigated those early years of healing, then I definitely recommend checking out his first appearance on the pod. It's not at all necessary to listen to that earlier episode to get the most out of today's conversation, but if you do want the full context or you just want to hear a really powerful and inspirational story, then I highly recommend checking it out. So I will put a link to that in the show notes if you want to check it out. And so in today's conversation, we are covering a whole lot of ground, but one of the main things that we're diving into are some recent decisions that Nate has made about his career and how he is aligning his work with his well-being. Specifically, he has decided that come the new year, he is waving goodbye to social media altogether and shifting his focus entirely onto what's actually good for his nervous system, which means dedicating himself to writing on Substack and nurturing his online community. So he is building a work life that actually feels sustainable for him. And I just thought that this was a very timely nudge for us all as we are wrapping up the year, to pause and ask ourselves what in our own lives isn't actually supportive to our nervous system's well-being. In other words, what might we need to step away from or maybe step towards to build a life that is actually a little kinder to our nervous system. And so when we're talking about what isn't supportive to us, there's a lot of things that we might consider, right? This could be certain behaviors or coping mechanisms. This could be certain relationships in your life. This could be certain commitments or environments. Maybe, you know, your job is completely draining you, or maybe there's like a volunteering gig that you took on, but now it just feels like, you know, more of an energy zapper than something that's adding something to your life. It could be the limiting beliefs that we hold about ourselves. In other words, a lot of things, guys, a lot of things might not be serving us, and that is okay to acknowledge. And if for some reason you're sitting there thinking like, I can't really come up with anything, which I don't believe, okay, I think that probably most of you are coming up with too many things, but in the small chance that there is anyone out there that's like, I can't think of anything. But I just did an episode on all the various ways that our body is keeping the score. And so perhaps you could tune into any clues that your body might be giving you, okay? Those could be like little breadcrumbs for you, like the chronic tension that you experience in your body, that hypervigilance, those protective body postures, like your shoulders being up to your ears like mine, that might be pointing you straight towards something that is not serving your nervous system's health. I do just wanna be absolutely clear here and say that this whole reflection exercise is not an invitation for you to just shame the shit out of yourself or decide that your whole life is a complete shit show, okay? We're not here for that. All we're doing is inviting information in, okay? This is just data. This is just insight. And it is by no means an opportunity to judge or criticize ourselves, okay? And we also need to be a little realistic here, right? Because there are some things that are just outside of our control or not something that we can change overnight. If you're unhappy with your job or where you live, it's not something that you can just snap your fingers and fix by January 1st, right? And like for me, one of the biggest things that is not serving my nervous system and has not been serving my nervous system for many, many, many a years is my relationship with my phone addiction. But if we're honest here, I'm a podcaster. I have a social media presence. I run a community off my phone, on an app on my phone. I can't just throw my phone out the window. It's not realistic to think that I'm going to be able to like magically conquer my phone addiction just because it's a new year. I've been working on this for what feels like a million years. Sometimes it gets better. Sometimes I relapse hard, and that's just a whole part of the process. And can we also just acknowledge that there like literally are people out there, let's just like refer to them as like evil geniuses of tech who have spent billions of dollars and a boatload of research on figuring out just how to get us hooked on our phones. Like it's some sort of, you know, digital crack pipe. So yeah, my phone addiction is not all on me. Just saying. The other aspect here, all the things that are no longer serving us are at the same time also serving us in a very meaningful way, right? It might not be logical. It might not make perfect sense on the surface, but there is a part of us that truly believes that holding on to this thing, whatever it is in some way keeping us safe. Like it's literally a form of survival for that part of us. So maybe this whole exercise is also an invitation to take a little time to reflect on how these things that aren't serving us anymore actually are serving us in some way, and to learn to have a little compassion for that part of ourselves. Because that's actually the most important piece to all of this. Because before we can even start to think about making tangible steps to let go of what's no longer serving us, we have to start with the compassion, the understanding, the acceptance for that part that's been holding on. That's really the heart of it here. Now, let's just for a second shift to that second part of the question that I posed. What can we step towards that will support our nervous system in this upcoming year? And I'm not asking you to set some like rigid goal of like, I'm going to get a new job, or I'm going to lose 10 pounds. In fact, just today in our shit show support group, we were talking about how important it is when we're looking at goal setting, what is actually a healthier approach is to just set like an intention on a feeling state. Like for me, I want to feel joy and ease, or setting some sort of, you know, process-oriented goal instead of an outcome-oriented goal. So instead of saying like, I want to lose 10 pounds, maybe it's saying like, I want to explore what it would feel like to treat my body with kindness, or I want to gently experiment with somatic healing practices and see what feels good for me. So basically, like, we're talking about the journey and not the destination. But if you do really want to start your year off on the right foot, let's just do a little shameless shilling while we're at it. You need to sign the hell up for Breathe to Heal, Release and Receive, which starts on Tuesday, January 13th. Because I'm not kidding you when I say that this is the kind of thing that can legitimately have a huge impact on your year ahead. And here's why I'm not just saying that, okay? So first off, for 7 weeks, you get 75 minutes a week dedicated just to your healing. Even if you can't make it live, there's a replay that is built-in me time, nervous system healing time for you every single week. Second, this course hits on both a limbic system level and a somatic healing level, which I talked about in the Body Keeps the Score episode, that these are the two types of healing that are necessary for us to resolve the damage of our childhood. So this is like a two-for-one deal, folks. This is a two-for-one deal on tackling complex trauma from all angles. Third, you are going to walk away with practical tools to help regulate your nervous system. Trust me, that is one of the biggest gifts that you can give yourself for the year ahead. Fourth, there are two emotional release breathwork flows that will help you to let go of some of that stuck survival energy that is inside of you. And finally, you get to do this all in a group of peers. Healing a community is such a powerful and a pretty amazing way to start your year off, right? Plus, it's nice to not have it to figure it all out on your own. You've got a roadmap and a supportive crew. So yes, just a little shameless plug from me, but one that might just make a big difference. So sign the hell up for Breathe to Heal, folks. Go to adulttraumapodcast.com/breathe to heal. On that note, let's just get on with the damn show, shall we? But first, let's talk about what you, yes, you need to damn the darn shit show, my online support community, where we have a minimum of 6 weekly Zoom support groups where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. This is a support community that's actually fun to be in, with a group of people who are not fuddy-duddies, who have a sense of humor. This is Relational Trauma. We heal relational trauma through safe relationships. This is where you can do so for less than $1 a day. So you, yes, you, the person that's been wanting to join for forever, how about you gift yourself a damn membership, okay? And also start your year off on the right foot too by being a part of this amazing shit show ship, okay? So let's just do it already. Head to adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow, or you can see a link in the show notes next. Give me a little follow on the TikTok, on the Instagram, at Adult Child Pod. Last but not least, want to give me a end of the year gift, a Christmas gift? Can you give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify? I'd really appreciate it. I really would. Thanks. Love you all. All right, shit shows, did you know that iron deficiency is one of the most common nutritional gaps? It affects 1 in 3 adults, and especially women. It often shows up as fatigue, brain fog, weakness, brittle nails. But the problem is that most people don't realize that low iron may be the cause of these issues. That's why I'm here to tell you about Siderol from Pharma Nutra. This is a premium iron supplement powered by patented sucrosomial technology, which helps your body absorb 3 to 4 times more iron while also avoiding the common side effects of traditional iron supplements like nausea, constipation, and all that fun stuff. It is clinically proven to be comparable to IV iron and is formulated with just 2 ingredients, iron and vitamin C. It's vegan, allergen-free, gluten-free. You can take it anytime, anywhere. So if you're that 1 out of 3 with an iron deficiency, head to pharmanutra-us.com and use code adultchild Child for 10% off your first order. That is PHARMANUTRA-US.com. Promo code adultchild for 10% off today.
Does anyone really know what hormones do? Like, there's so much talk around women's hormonal health, but most women are left even more confused about what it means for them and what the hell to do about that. So shit shows, let's leave this confusion behind as we head into the holiday season, shall we? Hormone Harmony is a game changer for women struggling with hormonal imbalances that leave them exhausted both physically and mentally. It only contains science-based ingredients that bring back comfort, energy, clarity, confidence, and a sense of balance. Perfect for enjoying the holidays and heading into the new year energized. And Happy Mammoth, the company that produces Hormone Harmony, is famous for its zero compromise policy. No GMOs, artificial fillers or flavor or any other junk. Only science-backed ingredients in amounts that are clinically proven. So this holiday season, give yourself or the woman in your life the gift of wellness. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code adultchild at checkout. That is happymammoth.com, code adultchild for 15% off today.
This isn't just a game, it's a once in a generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
All right. Well, we have writer and inner child whisperer. That's what I'm deeming you. Nate Postaway, right. Welcome.
Thank you.
So we were just talking about social media.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what has been your journey with social media? Like, before you started doing this as your career, were you on social media at all?
I was not.
No.
I had a Facebook account where I would be inactive for like 3 years, and then I'd be in a wedding and all of the events for that wedding, like I'd be a groomsman and I'd have to go to a Facebook group or whatever that was to like get all the details of where I was supposed to be. And then I would read on there for a day and be like, I don't like this. And I would go inactive again and log out for like 3 years until I was in another wedding.
What was your start exactly? Like, how did you first start talking about this? Like, what was your first like break in?
Yeah. So in my career, I hit just a burnout phase after 13 years in real estate. And I was living in Denver, my favorite city I had ever lived in, had a lot of respiratory issues there. But I started making these decisions of like, I came out and the year before. And then when I turned 40 the next year, I was like, I haven't really lived. And so that's when I planned to go travel the next year for the first time. And there was a lot of grief in that because I'd finally found a city where I felt like I belong, but health-wise, I knew this just wasn't going to be a place that I could stay long-term. So
was it like the allergies or like what was it exactly?
The altitude. The altitude and drugs combined. And I was a smoker for 21 years. I was a very heavy smoker for 21 years.
What did you smoke?
Marlboro menthol or either Newports.
Man.
Like a pack a day.
You ain't playing. So, you ain't playing.
Yeah. So,
smoking fiberglass.
I was like this little Alabama kid who watched my neighbors smoke. And I was like, they didn't give a shit about what people said about them. And I thought, I want to not give a shit. I'm going to smoke too. So I started like in the woods when I was 11 years old.
Well, I'm 5'11" and I always say, thank God I started smoking at 12 or I would have been 7'1". Right.
Yeah, it's interesting because like, I think it was maturity that helped me quit. But anyways, I got to the place where I knew that I kind of wanted a different life. I was 13 years in on my career. And when I left to travel, that's when I started Instagram. And I had to hire someone to explain to me what Instagram was because I didn't know and I wanted to understand it.
And were you doing it like you wanted to be like a travel blogger?
Not a travel blogger, but just start a conversation around trauma recovery and CPTSD. It was interesting because I had these two lives that were so compartmentalized. I had uber successful, hard worker, connected and community builder and hosting parties in my home and fundraisers. And then I had EMDR, fatigue, mental fog, depression. And those two things never existed at the same time, that, meaning I was able to keep them completely compartmentalized and never show how much I was suffering. And just keep in mind, like, there was also this umbrella of undiagnosed autism the entire time, which makes a lot of sense. But I was suffering a lot and I didn't have the ability to pull that together. And my thought was like, what if I found a way to start sharing parts of this journey while traveling and understanding myself a little better? The biggest part for me was I wanted to make a statement about coming out, not like a rainbow pride, but more like an unapologetic fuck you to every therapist and every pastor who had prayed to cast out demons over me and done so much damage that just took years from my life. That was the biggest, at that time, that was the biggest part for me of just like, I want people to know that it's not about being proud of being gay. It's being proud of being who I am.
And not giving a fuck of what you think about me.
Yes. And being unapologetic in their face. Mm-hmm. And so I traveled, started a blog, started sharing stories. And it was really interesting because I never set out to do coaching. I never set out to do webinars or workshops, but someone had reached out to me and said, I really think you should do more with this inner child stuff that you talk about.
Just a because random person?
It was someone who had followed me for a while who did marketing.
Okay.
And he was saying to me, I think I followed him as well. He was a like a life coach or something. And he said, you really should share more about this. And I had a friend who was a therapist who was telling me the same thing. And I was like, sure, I can do this. And they were like, you should do a webinar. I was like, absolutely, I should. What's a webinar? Like, I didn't know what the hell that was. And so they helped me put that together and the response was incredible. And I was like, I think that I'm being pulled more into this direction of with this. And I had a certification as a coach, but I was doing more consulting work at that time with real estate, life coaching, not necessarily trauma.
And so, life coaching.
Yeah, like so many past real estate agents were like, help me navigate this. And I was like, I've got you covered because I know that world so well. There was a pull into, hey, Nate, there's a need for a survivor's perspective to talk about things. Someone who has been at it for a long time, someone who understands the nuance and the complexities of what healing is like. There's a need here. And that's when I shifted where I was like, I'll start sharing more of my thoughts and ideas from the survivor's point of view. And it just took off. That was 2020. But I don't know if I told you this, but I did it for 6 months and it grew so fast that I got off in June after 6 months because I was like, I couldn't handle it. I didn't like the intensity. I didn't like the platforming of me as a person. I think that there's this idea of like, if you're on social media, you're starting a brand and you're this and you're this and you're this. And she's like, I'm none of those things. I still have low self-esteem. I struggle with my self-worth. And it just felt very performative. And the intensity of people asking for more and more and more. And at the time, there was no way to like block off DMs. And I was getting 30 or 40 stories a day from strangers either asking for a favor. And then also like emailing and it just became overwhelming. And so I got off of social media with no intentions of returning. And then a couple of therapists reached out and said, the way you speak is making a difference. One of my friends who's a therapist said, one of my clients brought one of your quotes into our session today. And I kind of reevaluated that and I thought, okay, but this has got to feel like it's more on my terms. When I got back on social media 4 months later, there was the option to turn the DMs off. So I did that right away. I hired someone to manage my emails because that was a part that was just, I understood that there are so many people who have pain and a need and that they're seeing a person identify something in them in ways that maybe other people haven't, but then they forget to see me as a person. And they forget to understand, like, this is someone who is sharing from a point of view with the hopes that you take his words and run with it. Mm-hmm. Not that you come back to him and say, what are the 12 steps? And I want to be a part of your life. And, you know, whatever that is. And it's taken a toll. It's really taken a toll. I also think that the transition, I will say that the momentum at that time was so beautiful. The heartbreaking part was seeing how many people related to my story. Mm-hmm. That was something that was eye-opening for me, bringing those compartments together of just recognizing the sexual trauma, the scapegoating role, the abuse within therapy, like all of those things.
Yeah, religious so trauma. Awful. I was thinking about that, how you have such a nice potpourri of all these different types of trauma, you know, the sexual identity stuff, religious, sexual abuse, some emotional neglect. You got it all sprinkled in there. We got some neurodivergency.
Yeah. But what's crazy is most survivors that I've met do.
Yep.
It's, and that's really what has turned me on to understanding the scapegoat role so much more, of just recognizing, I believe that there are people born into this world with incredible gifts of empathy and compassion and the way that they see the world. I see that within the autism community daily. And I think that provokes a lot of darkness in other people. I think that I was one of those examples of just born into an environment, a religion, a family, a decade where being who I was never going to be accepted. And without having a term like a diagnosis like autism and terms like nervous system, trauma, child abuse, I was this floating vessel into this life that was never mine. It was all about survival and adapting and figuring out how do I try to appease all of these people that continually remind me that I am unlovable, I am unwanted, and I deserve what they're doing to me. And that identity sticks with you and it shapes the way that you see the world. I'm still undoing that. Mm-hmm. I think the autism piece is what feels detrimental to that because of rigid thinking, black and white thinking.
Can you speak to that more? Do you want to talk about like just the process of getting diagnosed and realizing that? And also if you could really speak to what you've shared with me before about how there were certain symptoms that you had that you were hoping, you know, might improve. You thought they were CPTSD related and realizing sure. that they might have more of an autism base.
Sure. I want people to feel hope with both.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't feel like we can be honest and hopeful about CPTSD or autism without being clear about the damage that's been done and what the nervous system is actually going through. I feel like social media especially takes terms and then it becomes this blanket thing that we're just talking about and the depth and the layers of it dissolve. Mm-hmm. And we're missing a lot of that. I don't know if you've heard of that beautiful platform that's really pure called Twitter, but I was on there one day
that's my crap.
Yeah. Yeah. really wholesome, mm-hmm. really pure. And
it could be a great dopamine rush though. Nothing better.
There was a comment about being empathetic or highly sensitive or something. And just a group of people attacked this other person and that had left a comment on one of my posts. And, people were talking about autism and different things. And I started reading about it. This was 2020 and I was seeing a psychologist at the time. And I went to her and I said, hey, I read up on this and I'm pretty sure I'm autistic. And she just said, no, you're not. You just, the extent of the trauma and how long it went on, you have CPTSD and you're a highly sensitive person. You're just, you know, empathetic and whatever. And I was like, okay. So I put that away. Years later, I move and I'm working with a new therapist and we have since talked about my first session where I went into him. We're getting to know one another. He's probably the most gifted therapist I've ever worked with. He's a professor. He's a therapist. He runs a therapy group. And he sat and listened to me, you know, say all of these things. And I think on the first session, I was like, wow, these lights are really bright. Do you mind if we could turn these down and pick up on any sound? And I was like, pulling at my shirt because the tag was itching. It just, that was my daily life. And so I'm telling him all these stories and walking him through my life. And he was kind of on the edge of his seat waiting for me to say, and I'm autistic. And he was just like, and then I just skipped that part. And I think I asked him about this later. I said, did you know? And he said, you can't know, but I did. Yeah. He was like, but I was sitting with anticipation waiting for you to, he said, you were explaining autism in such clear terms. And he said, there was a disconnect for me of just questioning, has he never heard of autism? Is he in denial about what autism is? Like, you know, what's the story here? What I appreciated so much was he did not bring it up again for 2.5 months because he thought, I can't just bring this up without establishing a relationship with this guy. So on week 10, we're having this conversation and he's listening and he said, hey, what do you know about autism? And I shared the story about how 5 years ago I'd read about it and, you know, all of these things and whatever. And he had talked about, he said, your ability to communicate about pain is remarkable. He said, the way that you speak is very unique in the way that you put things together that most people can't. And he said, I wonder if you've ever looked more into, you know, different type of autism traits. I think that was his way of like easing me in to say like, hey, brother, you're autistic and it's not all bad. And so he took me through an assessment process and it was off the charts clear. And there's a lot of compassion for myself for the first time that I'd never experienced. I've always had this very detrimental relationship with myself. I've explained to people, it's not just a self-hate, it's the desire to unzip myself from my body and just get away from him, to just take a break. And then as soon as I started learning about autism, all of that made a lot of sense, because I think that people are comfortable talking about the positive traits in autism, but not comfortable sitting with what we actually live with every day and the changes that I've had to make in my life in order to not be a part of the demographic where, on average, people who are autistic live 14 years less than someone who's neurotypical. And that's a real statistic. I understand that statistic. I believe that statistic because I know how stress and overstimulation lives in my body. On a day where I have meditated and I've written in my journal and there's nothing that I can determine that's wrong and my body feels like it's on fire and I can't catch my breath and I have to retrace and do all of the things to try and manage that stimulation. So imagine living 45 years without that information while also experiencing the trauma ongoing for years. The grief was the acceptance that what I thought was CPTSD and what brought me shame, what I had coaching, I would have these coaching clients that I worked with and my work helped them soar into these new chapters in their life. And I thought, I'm not able to do that. I'm not having that kind of freedom. I'm not having those breakthroughs. And I would question like, how do I teach myself my own work? Like, what is this? And I felt kind of left behind of just like, maybe, you know, maybe because the abuse went on for so long that yours just isn't going to get better.
And then did you feel that way from like a perspective of like what was the aspect or what were the symptoms that were showing up that you felt like were holding you back?
Mostly physical, and then not being able to understand why I continually feel out of place and not able to adapt to circumstances or environments and make them make sense. So I identified everything as CPTSD and was trying to apply that lens and then felt the pressure of surely this is going to get better. Or this is going to get better. And then
the sensory stuff too.
Right. But you have to go through this process where you recognize, you know, holy shit, not only is this not going to improve, it's something that you're going to have to work with every day because of the way that your brain's mapped out the relationship between the amygdala and prefrontal cortex and the way that all of that wiring works. This is something that you have no choice but to surrender and figure out in order to create a life that feels more manageable.
So that's interesting when you bring up the brain component. Like for some of these symptoms, when we're viewing them from through the lens of autism, is something different going on in the brain?
There's so much information that I can only share mm-hmm. from a very limited view of what I learned. But
yes, you're not a we get it. You're not a neurologist. You know,
one of the theories is that children who are autistic, their amygdala grows a lot faster from birth to age 12, which obviously that would be very overstimulating. And then it slows down after 12. There's so much information about the wiring of the brain and how it's different for autism. One of the things that I read in one of the books that was fascinating is the guy said that scientifically, when you're autistic, you have a you experience stimulation at times at 40% greater. He was talking about one specific person, but 1% is notable. So imagine 40% where I'm understanding for the first time that people, not everybody feels a siren in their stomach. You don't know that other people aren't having the same experience that you're having. And then you find out like, you mean you can walk into a room with multiple sounds and not, your heart doesn't race? Like, I was learning that for the first time 2 years ago. And understanding that there's a name for all of this, and it's not CPTSD. There's no amount of meditation and breath work that's going to get me to adapt to that better.
So what did a change in managing certain symptoms look like now through the lens of autism?
I feel like my relationship with noise-canceling headphones changed drastically. Like, I always liked them, and then I loved them, where I understood, like, you have to have separation from stimulation. You have to have – I have to have long bouts of complete and total silence. The sound of a refrigerator buzzing is the best thing in the world for me, like, because that means that I can't hear anything else. I have to have just complete and total silence to let my body adapt and readjust as much as it can. Mm-hmm. What was the question? I completely forgot.
Just how you approached or managed different symptoms from a different perspective now under autism, whereas before you were viewing them more under CPTSD.
I invite autism into my day every day, and that's hard. It's interesting that there's a shame attached to it. Like, I was afraid to share with people that I was autistic because I see the way that autism is spoke of, and it's so dismissive. It's like anytime someone expresses poor behavior, someone's like, well, they may be on the spectrum. And it's just like, can y'all stop with the constant reference to autism being this like problematic thing, where my experience has been autism is the root to the compassion and the empathy that people have experienced in my teaching and in my writing. And that's fueled from autism. I will tell you that if I knew a way to scale that back and not feel such intense empathy every day, I would pick that. I would pick that in a heartbeat. It's really learning to be careful about how much you're exposed to in a day and understand your capacity, but it's just inviting it in. And so if a conflict that I had 5 years ago, now I have to say, Nate, you have rigid thinking. What is a possible option that you may not be thinking of in this particular scenario? That has been life-changing. That's been amazing. It's been freeing, but also there's this umbrella of shame that you feel like, do people still value me the same? And I think that the people who are doing in-depth work value me more. And there's a greater trust there of like, he has the mapping tools. And when he speaks about healing and trauma, he is coming from a place of having to navigate this without those tools. Mm-hmm. He knows how lost feels. Mm-hmm. He knows how dark feels in a world that he knows is not made for him. Mm-hmm. As far as his nervous system and brain is concerned. I think me not having the information means that I am constantly trying harder to make sure that everything works and everything fits, where someone who is neurotypical, I think, can shrug something off a lot easier and quicker and feel like this is odd or this is toxic or whatever. And they kind of just throw it to the side and they move on about their day. And I'm looking for patterns. I'm looking to understand if something seems disruptive or disconnected, I'm looking to put that back together. And I think that having the understanding of what being autistic is gives me more leeway and understanding to say there are limitations in what you need to be exposed to in order to show up the absolute best and most potent way for the people who need to hear about hanging on and hope, and you're not responsible for the rest. I think the way that it's helped is that when I did my first retreat, it was interesting that there were a lot of, we joked a lot. I'm known for my sense of humor, and I don't know how to explain that I'm funny, but I am. You have to trust me. But at my retreat, there were several comments where people said, it seems like compliments make you uncomfortable. And I was like, they don't make me uncomfortable, but I was not diagnosed, but I just said, I don't need them. And when I read about how being autistic, the reward centers in your brain are completely different, it made so much sense. I love when someone leaves a powerful message on one of my quotes about how it translated in their life. I love that, and that brings tears to my eyes, and that makes me happy. When people think that complimenting me helps me or makes them closer, it completely falls flat. It's in that same category of small talk or flirting. It's just not something, the way that my brain does not consider that as a reward or a dopamine hit at all. It's information. So I think that the beauty in that is getting to trust that someone is showing up, because from a place of life experience and desire, I have always wanted to help since I was a young kid. I've always been a helper. I want to be able to reach people and let it be about them. I want them to take words and information and soar. They don't have to tell me about it. They don't have to thank me. They don't have to do anything but just like take it and run. And I think there's also a surrender in it of just trying to pass off as much as I can to as many people as possible for them to have hope and feel like there is information that makes them make sense.
So at first you enjoyed social media, and what about it has changed over time and made your skin crawl?
This is us leading into my big shift. I think that when I got back on in 2020, it was beautiful to see people connect, to see a sense of community. It was also heartbreaking to see, like, this is a thing that so many people have experienced, just that, being the problem no matter where they are and experiencing abuse for years and being told the platitudes. Fast forward, at this point, there's so much AI on there. It just doesn't feel like there's room anymore for authentic exchange and conversation without you seeing yourself as a brand and build and grow and video and YouTube and podcast and logos on a shirt. That's not me. And I am looking to simplify my life. I am looking to preserve my work in a way that is meeting the people who are really hungry and have done enough searching to say, I need some extra help in getting through this CPTSD process, understanding autism, whatever those things are. And for me, that's no longer going to be social media. I'm done in January. It's interesting because I've talked to different publishers that have reached out for me to write a book and do all these different things. And they've all talked about I would need to keep that social media presence. And as soon as I decided 2 months ago that I'm shutting social media down in January, the peace that has come back to my life, the incredible improvement in my yoga practice, my mental health has gotten better. Like, just suddenly, I feel like I'm getting my life back. And now I'm just going to be doing Substack and that in my online group, Substack in my online group, and that's it. But something about getting back to just writing and knowing that if someone is connecting to my work, it's a very intentional thing. It's not this thing where this many followers and this and collaboration and ad, like it's not me. It's not me. I want to preserve what I've done the last 5 years, and I want to put it in a place where it's protected and it's not in this machine that's getting spread so thin that I can't feel like it's my words anymore. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. And I would kind of like to dissect this some, because I'm curious. So social media is, you're talking about it changing landscape. I guess, what is it that you feel like you can't continue to just exist in the way that you always have? Or is it just the time and effort?
I don't want to be there. Mm-hmm. And I think that that was the thing in 2020 that I lied to myself about. Mm-hmm. And that's great that so many people have connected with my work, and I hope that they continue to, but it needs to be on my terms. Mm-hmm. I think that social media is more of an expansion and building something. And what I want to build is something that feels like it's more on my terms, mm-hmm. and feels like I can pour creatively into it. I did everything that I was told to do this summer, and it ran me in the ground so fast. And I'm so glad that I was able to listen to that and look at that and then do some really hard questions and just ask myself, do you enjoy this work? I love this work. I love being with a person who is hurting and saying, I don't know my next steps, and knowing that I know how to hold space for that person in a unique way, where when they leave that space, they feel a little bit more put together. Mm-hmm. Social media dilutes that. Mm-hmm. Social media takes away from that. And I want to do my annual retreat. I want to run my online group, and I want to write. And I'll still do workshops and I'll do webinars, because those are helping a lot of people. But I don't want to participate in social media. I can't wait to log off. I'm removing those apps from my phone, and I'll direct everybody to Substack. But I look forward to just feeling a little bit more authentic about what I'm sharing.
Was there an internal struggle at all of feeling like you would be disappointing people? Was there a part of you that felt that way, as well as maybe like some unnecessary guilt of like, I'm trying to think about how it shows up for me. Sometimes there's a comparison thing for me, like when I see how many different things people have going on and all the different offerings they have. And there's a part of me that's like, why can't I get my shit together in that way? You know, but I don't want to do that many things. And certain things do feel inauthentic. And I think that's such a powerful observation of just how much inauthenticity there is in this healing space.
I also think that there's a crossover of people talking about topics that they have no business talking about. Mm-hmm. You're never going to hear me giving marriage advice. You're never going to hear me, like, it's just bizarre. You're starting to see a person become a brand, and then they think, I'm addressing everything. I recently saw a therapist calling people who are neurodivergent neurospicy, and then someone was correcting them in their comments, and the therapist defended themselves. And I'm just like, see, I'm sick of this. Like, I'm sick of people feeling comfortable making comments about topics that is not their lived experience. That's just strange. It's like, I'm not a journalist. I'm not someone who's like giving you live updates. I'm trying to provide genuine, concrete information that a person like me can grab onto and pull that into their mind and body and say, I feel like I make a little bit more sense right now. Now it feels like you log on and everything is a megaphone. It's just screaming at you, and it's not really actually teaching about alignment or healing or growth. Mm-hmm. For me, I think if other people are on there and they enjoy it, that's great. I just know that there's a relief for me that I know what I'm doing is more aligned with who I am and what I need in order to do my job the best possible way.
Can you tell me why saying neurospicy isn't okay?
I think it's fine. I think if you're not neurodivergent, please stop trying to teach people. And then when they correct you about something that you said, don't. It's like white people writing about racism, like writing books about racism. It's just like, please stop doing that. Like, please, please promote black authors when we're talking about racism. It's, does that make sense? Like,
yeah, 100%.
I had a friend recently who was just like, I'm reading the best book about anti-racism work, and it was by a white author. And I was like, what? Like, what are we doing?
Or it's like when the white person gets offended about something regarding a marginalized group, but the marginalized group itself isn't even offended.
Exactly. Just that, that there's just so much chaos, and social media breeds what you just said. They breed that conflict, polarization, yelling. I think too, I feel the most peace I've ever felt in my life, and the vision to teach has grown. The vision to help has grown. The confidence of like what I can say to a person or a group in order for them to leave there and feel more put together. All of that has grown so much. And in order to do that, I want to make sure that I'm fully aligned in what's right and pure and true for me. And it's not putting up snappy statements and competing with everybody else and promoting myself. That's just not what I want to do.
It's also listening to your body.
Before we started, I told you, like, as soon as I left Chicago in October to go check out this place in the Dominican Republic where I'm doing my retreat, because I always go to the place myself, and because before I host a retreat there, I want to experience it. And just being there and being off of social media for a few days and just realizing, like, you have to make some changes. If you want to teach and you want to be in front of people who are hurting and trying to find a path towards something different and new, you have to be fully aligned in your personal life. And you have to trust that the quality of what you build on your terms is so much better than the quantity on social media. And that's all coming together. Like, just, it's so aligned. It's a risk, but it's so aligned.
Yeah, there's a piece there. When you first started healing, were you somebody that, did you feel like you lived in a more of a chronic state of hypervigilance or in more of a numb state?
I would say hypervigilance, only because I've always been, I would say either or, but never conscious and never present. Mm-hmm. Hypervigilance from the place of always being a workaholic. Since I was 14, I got my first job that summer, and the guy, a coworker, I was cleaning up construction sites, and a coworker mentioned overtime, and I was like, what's that? And having that independence was my first route to, having that resource was my first route to independence. And that hooked something in me where I thought, that is what I want more of, is I want independence. So I think of that hypervigilance from always trying to escape my environment. Mm-hmm. And then I think numbing when I'm alone, mm-hmm. because I could not sit with the amount of information and pain and memories that lived inside of my body. I couldn't sit still.
Mm-hmm. And so did you feel completely disconnected from your body when you started healing?
At all times. When the therapist would say, you know, where do you feel that in my body? Sometimes I would be like, I don't know. Why don't you point to an area and I'll tell you if I feel that. Like, I had no feeling whatsoever. I had no connection to my body. For that to have been restored as much as it has been the last several years has been incredible. Reading was the first thing that I could ever sit still and do. And I would like to say that I'm a born reader. As a child, I loved books. The moment the abuse started and just trauma after trauma, I would observe readers and I would envy them. And I couldn't quite understand, how do they do that? And then when I did my first long round of EMDR, gosh, 15, 16 years ago, I was mailed a book, a couple of books from a relative not long after that. And I opened one of the books and I read it until 5 o'clock in the morning. I read the whole book. And then I realized you've never been able to sit still this long and you've never had the mental space to get lost in someone else's story because your brain was so chaotic and just in so much pain. So now things like that, when I sit down to read, my chest flutters. It's beautiful. Like I feel the actual sensation that I felt as a child of the excitement of being able to be still and just feel that alignment and that peace. It's lovely.
What's your favorite book?
I'm going to say that my favorite book is The Heart's Invisible Furies by John Boyne. I read it 2 years ago. It is 600 pages, and I think I read it in 3 days. It is heartbreaking. It's based in Ireland, but then he covers like Amsterdam, New York, back to Ireland. The story is just remarkable. It's really powerful.
I've never heard of it. Is it fiction?
Yeah, it's fiction. But I also love like The Perks of Being a Wallflower. Mm-hmm. It's an incredible book. A Confederacy of Dunces is one of the funniest books I've ever read. Has an incredible story. What's yours? What are some of your favorites?
I mean, the books that are nearest and dearest to my heart is Harry Potter.
Okay.
Because I read the first book when I was in the fourth grade, and then the last book came out after I graduated high school. So, I mean, I would sit and read those books in like a couple of days. So there's really nothing that like makes me feel the way that they do. But my brain has been so fucked by my phone, my attention span. I'm trying to be more conscious of it over the past year, but it's amazing how much more difficult it is for me to sit now and read a book.
Every story that I read about the way that dopamine is being translated in our brains and our attention spans are shrinking more and more and more. We have got to get away from video. We have got to get back to written words to expand that neuroplasticity. It's scary. Like, it's really scary. And I'm guilty of it. There are moments where if I'm having a stressful day and I'm cooking my breakfast, I will watch TV on my laptop. I will watch a show. But then when the breakfast is done, I then want TikTok because the show requires too much attention. When I noticed that, I was like, this has got to stop now. And I've learned to just eat meals with classical music playing in the background or my meditation music to just allow my mind and body to think and feel and be present. But it's so addictive to have access to information and entertainment and not realizing this is jacking up our nervous systems. This is making it where we're not able to be conscious and actually learn anymore. It's scary. And the information, there's so much misinformation. There's so much that's training us to think a certain way.
Oh yeah. I mean, it all is, you know? And I don't think like when you go down conspiracy holes too, just like the creation of social media too, I don't think it was like for good intentions. Yeah. But like I have a severe phone addiction, you know, like it's a problem and there's a lot of shame there. But it also is in remembering, like what you said, just realizing the amount of money and research that has gone into making us this way, you know, and that it's like it's not that easy. And then I think about it too, from like a creativity standpoint, if I've been on my phone all day and then I'm trying to work at the end of the day and trying to think of something creative, there's zero space for anything to come in.
What you just said has been a thought of mine multiple times, particularly with Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, mm-hmm. where if I've been on there and I'm writing my next workshop or I'm working on a session for my live group or I'm doing a long form blog, it's just different. I feel numb and there's no movement. I go walk along Lake Michigan. I'm listening to my music. I stretch on the floor. I'm good to go. Mm-hmm. I'm good to go. And I've always thought that like this spiritual side of life is kind of weird. I've got so much religious trauma that I just don't even want to hear about. When people are talking about religion, my response is like, tax the church. And just, I don't like whatever else you want to talk about. That's fine. Just tax the church. But I'm moving to this spiritual part of my life of understanding energy and alignment. And it's so beautiful to watch and experience what we can do when we take back the reins of saying, and I need to clarify this. When you have CPTSD, the expectation for you to meditate is absurd. Mm-hmm. It is absurd. I do not want anybody to hear me say wellness and meditation is the cure for anxiety, whatever. It took me years to learn how to be still. No one should feel shame about that. And I would go so far as to say that it can probably trigger a person to attempt to just be still when they're carrying all this in their body. The spiritual side that I'm really enjoying is just the thought of what my eyes see, what my ears hear, what my mind understands, and listening to my body. That's changing so much. I will also say that like my yoga practice has heavily influenced everything and has never been as strong as it is right now. When we talk about healing, the chaos of labeling some things, I will tell you this, at a gym that I was at not long ago, the owner said that one of his employees called in and said that he got PTSD from his move. Like he moved them. And I said, well, what happened? He was like, nothing happened. He moved. And he was like, people think that like stress equals PTSD. And I was like, that's social media. That's social media. I have no doubt that that person probably experienced a level of stress that they've not experienced before. That is not PTSD. So it's just seeing all of that language and inheriting it and trying to make it all make sense. I think it's really fucking up people's alignment where they're starting to question, well, I don't know how to gather all of this information and make this make sense. And I think if we could just get back to pure forms of creativity and connection, that alone will make such a huge difference for people where they feel like, I read this and I read a sentence in there and my body shifted. I felt a shift. I think that's the energy of that person presenting something from the purest place of what they have. I can't do that on social media anymore. I just can't do it because it's diluted and it's picked apart and it's about commenting or platforming me or whatever. That just doesn't feel accurate or aligned or all that helpful, honestly.
As somebody who endured so much religious trauma, was it difficult for you to get to a place of wanting to connect to something spiritually or a power greater than you? Was there a part of you that wanted absolutely nothing to do with any of that?
Yeah, because within the spiritual community lies the same exact mindset of people who are speaking down to others and saying, I have an understanding of something that you don't. And I think that's utter bullshit. I think that within religion, churches where I grew up, we're taking these average people who flunk out of college and are master manipulators, and we platform them, and it's called anointed. Mm-hmm. That person's anointed. They have a gift on their speaking and their leadership. What are we saying? And then I grew up with that, and being autistic, I always pushed back on things like that. It was just like, kind of seems like a creep. Like, but okay, like he doesn't seem anointed to me. Like that's fine. And again, these were the people that, you know, years ago prayed to cast out demons out of me, like when I was, you know, vulnerable and afraid. Within the spiritual community, anybody who simplifies things like autism or CPTSD or just a person who's hurting and suggests, well, you just have to change your energy or raise your vibration. Just, I can't stand that shit. I can't stand the simplification of any type of healing. When a hurt person is in front of you, it is humbling to be exposed to the vulnerability. No matter what you know, it is humbling to be exposed to them. And if you can't make it about serving them, you're not religious, you're not spiritual, you're entitled. You're still working with your ego. You're still having some sort of sensation. I enjoy helping people and I get pleasure from that. But the moment I start thinking they have to think like me or they just need to do this, you've lost sight of that person, mm-hmm. where they are, what they need, what's going to help them feel connected to themselves and important in their own life. The chasing of a type of religion or a specific church or a type of spirituality or a specific thing. I'm grateful that I'm coming to this later because there's not one thing that I believe in through and through that I feel like everybody needs to do this. That's not how minds and bodies work. I've never been offended when someone said, I don't relate to inner child work. That's good that you know that. That's good. Find what you do. When someone says EMDR triggered the hell out of me, I believe them. I absolutely believe that EMDR could trigger a person, especially if their clinician is not.
Doesn't know handling. What they're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. These things need to exist without the extremes. Mm-hmm. And I feel like within religion and within the spiritual community, there's a mirroring effect of people who have those extremes of like, this is the thing.
Black and white.
And this is how this. Yeah. Yeah. And if I, an autistic person, can get past that and expand, you can too.
Are you able to take any sort of spiritual significance in what you endured and the way that you've then impacted others to heal? Like, how do you feel about that? Does that sound like bullshit?
It sounds like bullshit, but I think when people say things like, was it worth it? I think that's inappropriate. I think let the person come to their terms with what it means. Mm-hmm. I had someone years ago ask me about the soul contract ordeal. Mm-hmm. I absolutely believe that's utter bullshit. Maybe I change my mind 5 years from now and that's something different. But I think to say to a trauma survivor, a childhood trauma survivor, that you chose this and you signed a soul contract before you came to Earth is so harmful. And so confusing to someone that's in the middle of that kind of pain. If there's truth to things like that, then why is it hurting the person? And then the person who relays that stands back and says, oh, you're just not ready to hear it. Well, if they weren't ready to hear it, why did you say it? Like, it's clear they're in pain. Why not just observe how much they're hurting and the vulnerability in that and show respect and reverence to how vulnerable they feel by sharing where they're coming from? I am amazed by yoga, particularly. I do hot yoga. And
do you do like Bikram or just like hot yoga?
Hot yoga. Yeah, they don't call it Bikram anymore
because he was a sexual deviant.
He is, yeah. But yeah, I do the 26 or I do hot vinyasa. I need the studio to be heated for sure. It's just different. In a studio that's not heated, I don't feel the same release. But I used to think that people who were so connected to yoga were strange because I didn't understand it and I didn't have that connection at all. They would talk about movement and different things. And I was just like, I'm just trying to get abs because I'm gay and like, you're supposed to have them. And now it's like, what an honor to be at a place where I understand my mind and body and I can go to a safe spot where no one's talking to me and no one's asking me for anything. And I get to just move around and know that when I leave, somehow energy is lessened, like it's lightened. That's incredible. That's incredible. And I think we can do that with our emotions and we can do that with many different things.
I realize that whenever I'm doing yoga that I've just had more of a realization still of how much just chronic tension I have in my body. Mm-hmm. And I just realized that when I'm doing yoga that I'm trying to get like the deepest stretch as possible, but in that I'm creating tension in another place in my body.
Wow.
And so I've been for the past few weeks just focusing on just like it's not about how deep the stretch feels. It's just more about like, how do I get my entire body to just relax?
Amazing.
Yeah.
Is it working?
Yeah. Yeah, I just did an episode. My episode this week was just on like the body keeps the score, and it just amazes me still just how much. Where did you, what about you from a body posture like perspective? Where did that show? Like, I'm somebody that shoulders constantly at the ears. Where did that show up for you?
Everywhere. I think the number of injuries that I've had shows such a disconnect. Mm. When I was 39 or 40, I had never really had an injury. Mm-hmm. And I've had the number of injuries just doesn't make sense. And also just like GI stuff. I've always had a very weak gut, and I very clear like the connection there. But I think that was really concerning. With my old job, I had to go to the ER once. And have you ever heard of allostatic load? This tells you what a workaholic I was. I went to the ER and they immediately said, have you been drinking alcohol? And at the time I wasn't a heavy drinker. I very much became a heavy drinker later, but at the time I was like, no. And my vital signs showed that my organs were so stressed. And she said, this is called allostatic load. This is just when your organs cannot function because you're under so much stress. And she said, I want you to go to the grocery store. Do not buy sugar. Do not buy any carbohydrates. Buy fruits. Buy juices. Drink a ton of water and drink tea. And I want you to go home and not leave your apartment for 7 days. When I went home, I was not under the impression that anything was terrible. When I went home, I slept 18 hours.
Wow.
The first 24 hours. That's how it showed up. And still just never really had an understanding of like, your body can't do this, Nate. Like, this isn't how this works. And luckily I have a lot more understanding of how those things work now. But it's shown up in injuries. And I think, just being disconnected and not really knowing, pushing way too hard at times, where when I think someone may pause, I push harder.
And ahead.
Realize like you can't do that. This is causing harm, legitimate harm.
So do you want to talk about your retreat coming up?
My retreat
Republic
is in the Dominican Republic at this beautiful oceanfront resort in the very north side of the DR. I went in October and I can't wait to get back. I keep them small. I keep them around 25, 26 people as a max, because I want everybody to feel included. Mm-hmm. We're going to do 2 sessions on the mind, body, soul connection, lots of amazing food, lots of walks on the beach, a lot of exploring in that area, a boat ride through a lagoon and the ocean and private beaches and a waterfall. Like, it's going to be amazing. So you can go to my website.
How many days is it?
6 days, 5 nights.
What sort of vetting process do you do, like, for people to come on your retreats?
It's mostly people that are in my group or people that have come to a past retreat, but we exchange emails and just make sure that it's a right fit. But I think the website too is just very clear that like, this is for the theme of this is rest, reset, laugh your ass off.
I love that.
Come to a place where you know that you're surrounded by people who understand pain. I do 2 long mornings, like long sessions, and then I do a recap every night. So when everybody kind of closes out their day, we gather together as a group and just do a check-in with the mind, body, soul. And I love leading retreats. I love leading retreats. I could never do like a big thing. I've been invited to do a couple things where I'm just like, that's not something that I feel. And again, maybe that changes. Maybe it's a confidence thing or some sort of alignment thing. But for now,
it's less authentic.
Yeah.
It's less personal.
It's the platforming for me that I feel like starts to depersonalize humanity, where we really need to stop the obsession with celebrities and just continue to put people on these pedestals and say, you're this, you're this, you're this. It's weird. It's strange. I just don't see a lot of people then converting that space into the better good. You know what I mean? Like, I just, it doesn't make sense. It's like, okay, so now you're you're very wealthy and you have everything that you need. And like, what are you doing to help all of the people that helped you get there? And it's just like, no, I'm chosen. That's what social media seems like to me. It's very strange.
Well, I hate to break it to people, but anybody that's huge, any big celebrity, they have made a deal with the devil, folks. I'm sorry. There's only one way you get up there. Okay. Have you set up your Substack?
I've set up my Substack. I'm going to have it go live probably in 2 weeks and then work my way off of social media for 30 days just to make sure that I
wean it off.
Yeah.
And then are you keeping the structure of your community the same?
Yes. I love my online group. It's smaller right now, and I think I really enjoy that too, where it feels more manageable and it's not in growth mode. It's like, this feels really solid. It feels very structured, very stable. I definitely do a vetting process there as well, just to make sure that people understand there are very clear guidelines to come into this space and engage. So
how do you differ between venting and trauma dumping?
I think that what I've seen on social media, and it's interesting that you said that, because it's one of the things that is so, it doesn't affect me. The trauma dumping does not affect me like, oh, I feel vicarious trauma from this. Mm-hmm. It's just exhausting and tiring to see people share such graphic details about their life with no connection to what they're doing to themselves by doing that, with just not the root and the anchor of understanding, like, hey, when you wake up a story like that, you're either going to have to numb yourself or do something after you wake that up. And I think social media has invited a lot of that. I don't know that I could. I think venting is probably just a little bit more intentional and doesn't necessarily have like graphic details, where the trauma dumping piece, I mean, I need to be so clear. Each of those people deserve a listening ear, deserve to be heard, have every right to want to get that story out of their body and want it to be observed and have someone meet them there. I just think that it's happening at a pace where we've lost some of the structure that's needed for people to actually feel safe in how they connect and how they tell those stories. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think that there's certain people that it becomes their personality, like their trauma story.
Yeah.
You know?
I think that it's a very real thing to be stuck in that place. I have no doubt that there have been chapters of my life where I was stuck and continue to repeat stories. And maybe that's why I have a response to it, because I see a part of myself that I didn't know or understand. But I definitely can see that there are parts that we think that we are healing ourselves and we're trying to get the story out, and we don't realize you're actually increasing your stress levels, mm-hmm. and you're creating more of a disconnect from yourself. And again, you deserve to be heard. You deserve to have that care and support. But without that person's permission and without that person being skilled enough to hold that space with you, it's going to cause more pain for everybody. I think the world is living through vicarious trauma right now.
Oh, shit. And
we've exposed everybody to just such horrific details throughout the world. Mm-hmm. And we're all just kind of walking around like, I don't even know how or what to
feel. Open gaping wounds. I think the most damaging thing about social media has been that negative attention is better than no attention.
Rage baiting. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that that was a thing. Like, every once in a while I'll see something like that and I'm like, it blows my mind.
I can get attention by like having some sort of mental health diagnosis. I mean, I think there's a lot of people out there that are just pretending, you know?
Did you watch that documentary? I think she was in Australia. I had never heard of this person, and it was before I was ever on social media, who made up a cancer diagnosis and like raised tons of money
I watched one thing called Scamanda, but she was here in the U.S.
Yeah, that too. That one too. With mm-hmm. all that one was like creepy with like the kids and whatever. But that's wild. Like that's wild to manipulate people's empathy like that. And I would fall for that. I want to be very clear. My caution, like I watch stuff like that. And when people are like, who would fall for that? I'm like, I would totally
right here,
fall for
right
that.
Here.
I would never like question when someone's shaved their head and sitting in front of a church sharing their story about their chemo. Like, why would I ever doubt that? Like, that just would not cross my mind.
I'm like the person who would doubt the person that has legitimate cancer.
Really?
I think everyone's full shit. You know, one last thing, we were talking about AI. One thing that I just had to do is I sent my parents a text and I told them that because now with AI, like scammers are calling people and using your voice. And so with my voice being so public out there, like I'm like, I think we need to have like a code word in case they're trying to call you and get money. You know, that shit's freaky.
That's so scary. That's so scary.
So, all right. Well, we'll put all your links in the show notes and you'll still be here, but you'll just be in the places where you want to be. Yeah. And like, how freeing is that? And what a great example that like you're choosing you and what feels good to you and your body. And it doesn't matter what everyone else is fucking doing.
Thank you. Thank you.
Next interview, you're going to look like 10 years younger.
I hope.
You know?
What you holding on to? Just let it all go. Slow now, but don't let it all go. What you got to do, yeah.
All right, Shisha, so let's see if any of these apply to you, okay? You've done the therapy, you've read the books, but you have yet to dip your toe into the somatic healing pond. You still find yourself having reactions that are out of proportion to the situation at hand. You live in a constant low-grade state of hypervigilance, like you're waiting for the other shoe to drop. Or you're on the opposite end, you're checked out, disconnected, floating through life like your head is a completely separate entity from the rest of your body. You live in chronic tension, your shoulders are up to your ears like mine, or your jaws clenched, hips tight, lower back pain, or you deal with digestive issues, or you're constantly tired in a way that sleep just doesn't seem to fix. And last but not least, you're craving a place to heal with other cool people where you can just show up as your whole messy self and be accepted for it. So if any of those applied to you, and let's get real, shit shows, at least one of those applied to you, it's time that you sign the hell up or breathe to heal. This 7-week journey kicks off on Tuesday, January 13th. It's led by Teresa, fellow shit show member and somatic and breathwork practitioner. And it combines the three modalities that literally helped me thaw out of functional freeze and start moving my life in the direction I actually wanted. Breath work, somatic practices, and parts work. This is a steal compared to other somatic programs out there with 2 and 3 month payment options to make it more accessible. So you, let's do the damn thing already. Head to adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal. That is breathe with an E at the end, adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal to get your damn spot and thank me later.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.